Okay, let's see if the... Oh, it does. It works. I can hear me, right? Welcome back. That's awesome power. But welcome back, and welcome to Wednesday. Syllabi are here if you didn't get one. There's also a handout which is for next week. If you didn't get it, it's down here. It'll be here after class. Bring it back with you Wednesday. This is a test to see if you can remember to bring it back on Wednesday. Questions? You've had a chance to memorize the syllabus and start to worry. What did I not say on Monday that I needed to say? One thing that I was aware of, and that is that if you look at the reading assignments, something you have to look very carefully and you have to study them across the semester. What you'll discover, and I'm going to warn you now so you don't discover it in early November, is that there is almost twice as much reading in the third unit as in each of the other two units. About the same amount. So the last third of the course has about half of the reading, which means there's more reading toward the end. And that sometimes surprises people when they say, I'm reading as much as I was earlier, but I'm not getting any closer to the end. So just be aware that the reading is set up so that it's packed a bit more fully into the third unit. You've been warned. Anything else I forgot? Let me also introduce Colin Oliver, who will now stand up and wave. Don't tell me there are other softball players in the room. Probably, yeah. Okay. Colin is going to be assisting us with the course, so she can answer questions too, along with Talia and me. No other questions? Okay, you had your chance. Let me recap what I had, some of the things that I said on Monday, especially to remind you of some of the important pieces, and also to fill in some gaps and to start to orient the people who've joined us. If you have joined us since Monday, get the syllabus, get the text, sit down with three or four other people and go over what they think I said on Monday, and also get onto the website, which is listed in the syllabus, and check the audio recording of Monday's lecture, which is up, so you can actually hear what I said on Monday. Okay? Some basic assumptions. I didn't put these up, but I wanted to review them a little bit. As I was describing the way my mind works, one of the important concepts is domains. And my point was that it's too complex to think about people, even a person, in all of the ways that we possibly can all at once. So we slice the person up into layers, which in this case we call domains, as a way of whittling us down to size. I mentioned several domains. We will be talking about the biological domain first, and then the cognitive domain, and then the interpersonal or psychosocial domains in the third unit. We're not going to talk about the spiritual domain. We're not going to talk about geography. We're not going to talk about other slices that we could take through the person to take a particular perspective. We're not going to do that. We're going to divide people and the subject matter into those domains just for convenience. There's not any particular inherent truth in them. It's not necessary to do that. It's convenient for us to do that. This list that I give you does go from the most concrete, sort of the real hard science stuff. You can actually look at cells. You can look at blood. You can look at the nervous system, and we can study it scientifically, and there's not much argument about what something is or what it means or whether or not it's there. When we move to intellectual processes, there's much more room for interpretation, much more room for argument, and it's harder for us when we talk about cognitive processes to claim that something is really, really true. It's always subject to interpretation. As we move up into the psychosocial domains, there's even more room for interpretation, and instead of one or two theories, we have 52 or 16 or some random number of theories about personality, all of which are potentially useful, but none of which is really concretely, provably true. And when we get up into the realm of the spiritual, then we're into belief, and even the theories sometimes clash greatly with each other as people argue about what is really true about a person's soul or spirit. Okay? So that's one of our assumptions. Another assumption that I made on Monday is that a whole lifespan is too complex to think about as a whole. So we divide it up into segments, and we particularly look at the transitions that are expectable and the stages that those transitions come between. Again, those are for convenience, because I want you to think about the whole lifespan and see it as continuous from conception to recycling. But to talk about it, we're going to have to talk about particular events, particular transitions, and particular stages. And the third assumption is that there are things that happen to some of us, but not all. There are relatively unique things, events that happen to us. We are developing as we cope with the events that happen to us. So, what happens to you, the sorts of things that you happen across in life, the kinds of misfortunes that befall you, or the opportunities that you stumble into or that are thrust upon you, those misfortunes and opportunities, the activities that you get involved in, those are part of the stuff that you're using to develop. And the stuff that we do, the stuff that we encounter, the stuff we live through, differs among us. Some of it is fairly predictable, and some of it is not. So as we're developing, we're facing things that we can expect to happen, which we call normative. They're normal. We expect them. If they don't happen, we may question why. And then there are other events that we will call non-normative because they are unusual. They don't happen to everybody. And when they happen, we may say, well, why did that happen? And how do I make sense out of that? Because it didn't happen to most people. And so we'll think about normative or typical events, and we're going to focus on those in this course. But we'll also talk about the non-normative or unexpected events, the atypical events that happen to people, and talk more generally about how people respond to those and how they cope with them, what their role is in development. For the normative events, Most of them also have a normal time when they happen. So we expect puberty to happen starting about 9 for girls and 11 or 12 for boys. We expect it to happen, but it might happen later than that. If it doesn't happen, that's really non-normative, but there are people for whom puberty doesn't happen, and that has a profound effect on their development. But for some people, it may happen way off time. It may happen starting at 5 or 6. It may happen starting at 17 or 18 or 19. When that happens, when a normative event happens but happens off time, because it's early or late, that affects development as well. So development is different if you're going through normative events off time than it is if you're going through normative events at about the time that everybody else is going through them. Okay. So we'll come back to those concepts of normative and non-normative and on time and off time for the normative events as we go through the course. Okay, so we're going to differentiate people into the set of three domains. We're going to look at transitions. We're going to look at stages. Our task, as I was saying at the end, our task is to get through all that and then to try to put the domains and the stages and the transitions together so that we can talk about a particular person's whole life. And we'll ask, what is common for all of us? How do we develop? What makes people develop, whether they're on time or off time? What are the processes? And what I had put on the board, we call a matrix, and it helps us organize our reading, our thinking. It's also a source of hypotheses. For example, this is sort of what I had on the board. This one's a little fancier than what I had. Okay. So it has stages at the bottom, prenatal, infancy, early childhood, as I did on the board, and events or transitions. This is on the web, so you don't need to try to copy it down. And as I said, we're going through the biological domain from start to finish. Then we're going to come back and add the cognitive domain to that. And as we do that, one of the hypotheses that we're going to entertain regularly is that there's some connection between the biological changes that are taking place and the cognitive changes that are taking place. So if I know my brain is developing, as it does, and we'll talk about that, you'll read about that, how the brain changes. As the brain changes, the ways it deals with information can change, and that can change the way you think. Conversely, if I'm thinking about something, perhaps something unusual, a lot when I'm a child, I get to entertain the hypothesis that that thinking about something particular will change my brain biologically. Okay. So if I'm, for example, as a child viewing a lot of pornography, and I'm exposed to a lot of pornography, and I'm thinking about that a lot, parts of my brain may be affected by that and change the way I think and the way that my brain operates for the rest of my life. Okay. If I'm particularly stressed during adolescence, and I'm thinking about things that are very stressful constantly, and I'm always upset in my thinking as I go through adolescence, I may be altering the biology of my brain. And that may have a permanent effect on the way I deal with relationships, the way I deal with information, the way I think, and my ability to think. So this matrix gives us the reminder that we need to be thinking about the transactions between the domains. And it's not just the brain affecting my thinking, the way I think and what I think about my opportunities to think may affect the way my brain develops. Then when we get to Unit 3, we'll add the third domain, and again, we'll ask questions about how has the biological development changed what's going on in my relationships or in my personality? How do my relationships affect my thinking and my biological development? Again, we will assume, for the sake of argument and for thinking about research we might do, that the influences go in all the possible directions. Okay. Now that refers, as I've described it, primarily to the relationships among change in each domain at a particular time. But this matrix also gives us the potential to think about whether things that happen biologically early in life might have some connection to things that happen later in life. The things that happen later are never going to affect you earlier. We do know that. Okay, so it's only going this way. But will the interpersonal experiences that I have as an infant affect my biology later or my thinking later? Just as a tease, when you get to the section on adolescence in the text, you'll find a note about the impact of growing up in a household, if you're female, growing up in a household that includes males, adult males, who are not biologically related to you. Stepfathers, mother's boyfriend, father's boyfriend, I guess, all of those possibilities. Older stepbrothers. Okay. That's a psychosocial experience. Being female as a child in a household with men who are not biologically related to you. Stepfathers, boyfriends, older stepbrothers who are not half-brothers. Does that have any influence on anything? Well, the tease is, yeah. If you're female and grow up in that kind of situation, it accelerates the onset of puberty. Okay. So females who grow up in a household with non-related adult males tend to go through puberty earlier than they would have if they had been in a household without those males in it, if they had their biological fathers and brothers in the household. It's a few months difference, but it's consistent. And it's an effect of a psychosocial experience on a biological process. We'll look at some others of that too. One of my favorite questions somewhere along the line will be, what difference does it make if you have a happy marriage or a happy adult relationship with a partner as you go through adulthood? One of the differences that it makes is that you're healthier and tend to live longer. So your interpersonal relationships and their quality has a direct influence on your biological health and your longevity. Okay, so put that matrix in your head. It's part of what I'm going to try to make sure is there so that you can reproduce it, think it. I recommend it as a way of organizing everything that you read. What domain am I talking about? What stage or transition am I reading about? Am I reading about relationships among those domains and between those stages and events? And in which direction are they? So it's a way of organizing the material. And the last thing I said on Monday was that I'd like you, by the end of the course, to have a start on considering any particular event or transition, a person at any particular point in life, and describe what might be going on in each domain. Okay. So just, if you're talking about a 15-year-old girl, what is likely to be going on in her life, and how might the three domains be influencing each other? And if there's a particular event or transition going on, how might the person cope with that? How might it influence other aspects of life? So think developmentally. Okay? So that's where I was up to with a little more detail filled in. And now everybody likes to know what biases, well, maybe you don't. I hope you do. I'm going to tell you what my biases are. Okay, so I want you to be able to think like I do, of course. Why else would one teach? I'm trying to get you to think like I do, so I should tell you how I think. That's how my brain is organized. I have five perspectives. These are on the web. Don't write them down. But I just wanted to elaborate a little bit and let you hear the words come out of my mouth so that you'll know what's really important to me and what I would like you to begin to develop. And the first of those perspectives we call a developmental perspective. I tend, and always try, to think about change. And I'm interested in how you think about change. I'm not interested in what a person is like right now. Well, I'm interested, but I'm even more interested about how that person got to be how he or she is now, and how he or she is changing, and where he or she is going. What practical implication does that have? Well, one is, I don't believe that any of you will be the same next year as you are now. That may be a relief to some of you, that I believe you will change. I believe most of you are going to go through significant experiences over the next year from which you will develop, and they will change you. And I'm curious about how that change is going to happen, how you're going to be different. I hope it's for the better. For some of you, it may not be, but we can explain that too. How is a developmental perspective helpful? Well, if you're parenting, or if you're teaching, or if you're a social worker, or if you're in any of the helping professions, you will eventually be confronted with somebody whose behavior you don't like. That happens a lot. It's happened to some of you already. You have a sibling or somebody who behaves in ways that you don't like. Some of us even get into or come to the notice of people who are supposed to change our behavior. And working in schools and working in programs for delinquents and mental health programs, my experience has been that many of the people who work in them have dealt with problems and tried to change the problems, get rid of the problems, without understanding the processes of development. People don't suddenly have problems. They develop problems. Or they have problems that get worse because they haven't learned something that would help them not have the problem. It's much easier to figure out how to help somebody change if you have a developmental perspective than if you just want to give them a pill that says they will stop being delinquent, or they will suddenly become a nice person, or they will suddenly learn to read. A developmental perspective suggests that you have to help the person develop, and that means understanding how the person got to where he or she is, how the particular issue developed, how the skills have developed or not, and then you facilitate the development. And that may be harder than just giving a person a pill so they can learn to read. On the other hand, giving a person a pill so they learn to read isn't possible. So teaching them to read and developing the skills that they need is actually easier, even though it's a lot more work. But if you don't understand development, and if you don't assume that the problem developed in some way and you need to develop the person out of it, you're two strikes behind when you start. One of my favorite things to do when I go into schools is ask people what they do and what schools are for. And it's fun to get the answers. I was a school board chairperson for several years at Mount Mansfield Union High School and the middle schools associated with it. And it was fun to talk to people about what schools were for. Ask parents what schools are for. Ask teachers what schools are for. And they give you all kinds of interesting answers about teaching and preparing citizens and teaching math and physics and all those sorts of things. But from my perspective, the purpose of schools is to facilitate development. And people look at me like, some kind of nut we got in here. But I want you to think about change. I want you to think about development through this course and the rest of your life every time you turn around. I also am a constructivist. That's a theoretical and philosophical perspective, particularly about how things develop. And a constructivist approach assumes that I don't pour knowledge into your head. You didn't get born with an understanding of human development. You have constructed it to the extent that you have an understanding out of your experience. The human brain and human mind have evolved to let us make sense out of our experience. But we have to actively make the sense. Sleeping on the textbook will happen. Some of you have probably already discovered it's a great way to go to sleep. You just pick up Papalia, read a few pages, and you're out. That's why it costs so much money. It has all that power to put you to sleep built into it. But sleeping on it is not going to get any understanding in your head. Reading it may not get any understanding in your head. You've had that experience, right? You can read a textbook, you can go through the motions, you can pass the words from eyes through wherever they go, in one head and out the other. But unless you actively engage the ideas and think about them and try to connect them to other things that you already know, to experiences that you have had, you're not going to construct any understanding, which is why you can go through a 580-page textbook, read it all, pass the course with a multiple-choice exam, and not remember a thing that will be useful a year later, because you haven't constructed any knowledge. You construct your understanding by engaging the information, applying the information, experiencing the information, plowing through it, making sense out of it, thinking about it, talking about it, questioning it. It's a process of engagement, of actively constructing, actively creating your understanding. Not the book's understanding. Not my understanding. Your own understanding. And every one of you will experience this course uniquely, as you experience everything uniquely. Not that you can't learn from each other by talking with each other and sharing your ideas. That's part of the constructive process. But each of you ends up with your own understanding for which you are responsible. If there's any credit to be given, It's to whoever provides an opportunity for you to engage the material. Whoever tells you a story that you actually remember and can remember and apply later. But the understanding of the story and its application later is something that you create. You create it. So I believe that children and adolescents and adults and old people are constantly constructing their understanding of the world and their skills, and that's a lifelong process. Third perspective, contextual. None of us exists in a vacuum. We are social animals. We exist in a set of relationships at a particular time, in particular places. And you can't understand development without looking at the relationship, the transactions that are going on between the person and the environment, the context. What you can learn, what you can know, how you can develop depends on where you are and when you are, not just on who you are. Because who you are is itself dependent on where you are and when you are. And related to that, these are not mutually exclusive. These tend to go together. They fit in a package. The fourth perspective we call the transactional perspective. And I meant to go the other way. Okay. Transactional perspective is important to me. And transaction is what happens between two people or between a person and the environment. As the two people are mutually influencing each other, or the person and the environment are mutually influencing each other. And this is sometimes a little difficult to get your mind around, to think about not just a person and not just a relationship, but the transaction that is going on between two people. And I will constantly be talking about transactions that people are having. The important transactions in our lives are the ones that influence our development. And I think that we are often influenced most in our lives by the transactions that we have with the material, with a person, with multiple people, and that we are simultaneously being changed by those transactions and changing the other people. We'll elaborate on that as we go along. I'm not going to belabor it at the moment. There is a fifth perspective that I have, which is really just a bias, which I call application, the applied perspective. I like theories. They're kind of fun, but only if I can apply them. I'm kind of a practical sort of person. I'm interested in real life, real problems, real people, real issues, real development, real environments, real families, real thinking, and what I can do with the knowledge that I have. So I like when you ask me questions about particular situations. I like when you bring examples in from real life, and I encourage you to try to apply the material from this course to your real life and the lives of people around you. Use life as a laboratory for checking out the ideas that you read in the text or the things that I talk about. Look for examples and bring them in. The fact that I'm interested in application means that there are large chunks of the text that I will leap nimbly over because they might be interesting to the researchers who do the research or the theoreticians who write about it, But if I can't come up with some way that it's useful in the world, I'm likely to skip nimbly over it and not think about it very much. On the other hand, once I figure out something is useful, I'll grab it, I'll hang on to it like a bulldog until it turns out to be wrong or not very useful. Okay, that's the end of the introduction. So let's turn to Unit 1. Focus questions. These are in the syllabus for the biological unit. Where did you come from and what did you bring with you? How many of you heard the story about little Tommy who goes into the kitchen, asks his mother, "Mommy, where did I come from?" Mommy takes a deep breath, very deep breath. She starts to sweat a little bit. She gets anxious. She tries to remember what she learned in HDFS 65 about sexuality and explaining it to little kids. She says, "Okay, let's have a cookie. Let's have some milk." She sits down and she gives him the whole birds and bees lecture about when mommy and daddy were loving each other very, very much. And, you know, you'll have to take 65 to get the rest of it. And Tommy says, "Oh, that's very interesting, Mommy. But where did I come from? Billy said he came from St. Louis." All right. "Where did you come from? And what did you bring with you?" These are questions to think about as you read, as you watch the video that we're about to watch, as you attend class, as you think about the material. See if you can come up with answers to these, and I will try to give you enough material to answer them. What are genes? What do they do? And how do they do it? How do we get from a single cell, as I mentioned on Monday, just the zygote at the beginning, to the trillions and trillions of cells that you are now, or billions and billions, or however many there are? Why do you have a belly button? And what's it connected to? How did you know what to do when you were born? How did you learn to walk? And let me expand on that question. When we look at motor development, I'm also going to ask you, how did you learn to stand up? How did you learn to crawl? How did you learn to roll over? How did you learn to play soccer? Round the bases for the softball players? Get out of the way when a line drive comes toward you? How did you learn to do those things? How are boys and girls different biologically, and when do those differences become important? When will they? They're not important to you, most of you, yet. When are you at your physical peak, and what happens after that? I already told you that on Monday. How can you manage to live a long and healthy life? Why does menopause happen? And let me add to that, when we talk about puberty, I'll talk about how puberty happens, and then I'm going to ask you, what's the relationship between what happens at puberty and what happens at menopause for women? When and why will you die? There's a sobering thought. You will. And you get to determine to some extent when and from what or why you will die. And we'll look for constructivist and transactional perspectives in biological development. Okay, questions at this point? Promise them a video and they just want to do it, right? Okay. Bear with me, because I have to remember how to do this. We will get there. Some of you have seen this. It's worth seeing again. So we will. Okay. That doesn't work. That works. Good.